All right, let me tell you a story. I like stories, and this isn't a bad one. My wife and I was officiating a wedding in St. Louis, and the couple, which is pretty normal, they got us a hotel room for the night because we were there Friday night for the rehearsal. Had to come back Saturday morning, obviously, for the wedding. And so since it was far away, they got us a hotel room for the night. So we stayed in St. Louis, went to their rehearsal dinner. It was great. Stayed at the hotel. It was great. And it wasn't a part of the city. It was a little further north from downtown. I don't remember exactly where. But it wasn't a part of the city I was all that familiar with. And so after we checked out of the hotel, we had some downtime. We knew we needed to eat lunch, and we didn't really have anything to do. So we just walked around. Figured we'd find some corner restaurant somewhere and eat lunch together. It was nice, just hanging out during the day. But we walked around. The place that we were around had a lot of neat stuff to look at, but there wasn't really much to eat. And so time was kind of ticking, and eventually we got to the point where we realized, you know, we don't have probably enough time anymore to go to a real restaurant. Now we're probably looking for fast food. But we weren't seeing a lot of that either. And so we kept walking around, and we came to this mall. And it had a sign that said, food court open. And we thought, that'll work, you know, fast. So we go into this mall, and my first clue that something was weird should have been that there was this tiny, nappy grocery store in the mall. That was like when you walked in the front doors, and there were a lot of people walking in and out, you turned right into this giant, or actually not giant at all, this tiny, nasty grocery store. And everybody who was going in was going to the grocery store. And we thought, that's a little bit weird. And so there's a sign a little bit further on that says, food court on the top floor, still open. We're like, still open? What does that mean? And so we walk out. We walk past the entrance to the grocery stores over here. We walk into the mall, and three or four levels of a mall. Okay, it's a big, big mall. And nothing is there. Not a store. All the chains are down, and there's nothing behind the chains except boxes and dirt and stuff. Four levels of a mall that is a ghost mall, and a sign that says food court on the top floor still open. And we're looking around. We just got past the little nappy the grocery store, and we're thinking, what is the food court going to look like? Because legitimately, from that vantage point, there's one working escalator that goes to the top. Everything else is shut down, barred, chained. It's ghost mall. And so how do you not? Of course, we have to go to the fourth floor because we're already into the story. And so we do, and we go all the way up to the fourth floor, and there's one thing open in the food court, and it's like one of those little mall pizza places that's in a really nice mall is already a place you probably would avoid eating, okay? But it was hilarious. We sat there. I mean, we're dressed to the nines, too, because I'm getting ready to officiate a wedding, and she's there with me. So I'm in a black suit, and she's in a really nice dress, and we are eating. And in this, there are more homeless people than customers in this mall. Like, it's just dirty and broken everywhere. And as we're sitting there eating, kind of laughing to ourselves, talking about how weird this all is, we're overlooking the mall, this vacant mess. And I'm looking around, and kind of off to the side beside us, there is a fountain. It's not working. It doesn't have any water in it. The pipes are all corroded and rusty and nasty, and it's dirty. But I started looking at it, and the tile work on it was really intricate. You know, I mean, around the sides, the whole thing was built out of stone and tile, and it was really well done. Whoever did it knew what they were doing. And they had taken little pieces of the tile, and they had made these. It wasn't just a fountain; it was art. Like somebody had gone and taken all these tiny little pieces of tile, and they'd created mosaics, artwork all the way around this thing. And I started looking at that, and thinking about what that fountain would look like if it was cleaned up, if it had water in it. It was kind of cool. I sat there looking at that fountain, thinking that is a beautiful fountain that's just covered in garbage. I mean, you look at it and you think broken. But in reality, it was just gorgeous. Somebody had put a lot of man hours and investment in there. And I wondered, as I was looking at it, I'm wondering in my mind's eye, I'm thinking of kids in this mall's heyday throwing pennies and stuff in, and then when their parents are turning around, they're scooping change out, you know, and throwing it back in again and doing all kinds of stuff. And so I start looking around the mall with those eyes, you know, like looking at the rest of the mall, because there's marble pillars, and it's not a bad mall, I guess is what I'm saying. I hate malls, okay? So like I get anxiety disorder in a mall. After about 40 minutes, I hit a wall, and I don't know if it's a guy gene or what goes on there, but yeah. So this has taken something for me to say, but as I'm looking around, I begin to imagine what this mall should look like. You know what I'm saying? Like being able to smell coffee from one side and like obnoxious perfume from the other side, the two stores that are competing like right there together. And I can picture Christmas time with just decorations everywhere and people going crazy and, I mean, like shiny floors as what this mall could or should have looked like. I mean, I was just thinking about the guy who designed the fountain, whoever it was, the artist who sat down and designed and the handiwork that was displayed there. What a wonderful thing it would be for him to watch kids play with that fountain, you know? And now it's in a defunct ghost mall. And I don't know, maybe they renovated it. That's been like 10 years ago probably. But as I looked around, I thought, man, this place, I could see what it could be, I guess is what I'm trying to get at there. Pete, would you mind hitting the lights here? This room, have you guys ever taken a look at Capen Auditorium? Speaking of ghost malls, this is a cool room. Have you ever noticed this? Look past the nasty carpet, all right? And look past the fact that like every other seat is broken. Some of you are sitting in seats that at any moment could just completely give out. Can you do the ceiling too? Can you hit them all on? This building was built in the 20s. Look at the pillars and the archway, this giant archway that covers the balcony. And above my head, the artwork that's up there, that at one time was wood before they decided to paint over it with peach and maroon. Like, about 2 or 3 years ago, these curtains weren't black. They were still like this nasty gold from the 70s when they remodeled this place, okay? Somewhere along the line, I'm guessing that that's tin. I'm not sure, but the design in the ceiling is probably tin. Somewhere along the line, they put the fluorescent lighting in, which is usually ugly, okay? Mounted it into the tin ceiling and painted it white. Covered up all the windows that are here. On both sides, those are all windows that are there. Old carpet that's here. Old seating that's here. I mean, the carpet looks just like it's about to grow a life of itself and walk away, you know? In this room, can you picture it in its heyday with this stuff as wood and ornate and beautiful? In the 20s, they showed silent movies in this building. Can you picture students getting dressed up on campus and how cool it would be to have something being shown on campus where they're going to come in this room dressed to the nines and watch silent movies together? In the 20s, they're doing this. And it has been remodeled once since then. I looked it up, okay? Just once. But once, they remodeled it since the 20s, okay? But this room, I mean, this room's an example of it. If you remove the peach and maroon and a lot of the paint, you can kind of see, can't you, what was here at one time? And it'd take a lot of money to get it back to that spot, but it's here in this room. There's some cool stuff here. Thanks. If you take the same thing, if you can use your imagination a bit and you look at the broken world that we live in, a world where there's broken relationships, where there's just decay, where we have self-image issues and there's cancer. And I mean, if you can just dig your fingernails a little bit past that and use your imagination to get to a point where you can see this world the way it was intentionally designed to be, Genesis looks so beautiful at the beginning. And you can see it. Because you can see the beautiful things too, you know? We have a picture of love, and we know what it is. And when we dream about that a little bit, we can see love in its purest form, without miscommunication, without manipulation. We can see what love is. We can see the way that God designed us to be. It's cool, isn't it? That this idea that God created this world, and he's moving us back that direction. The decay that's going on in this world, that door is going to close. And we're going to be ushered into a time where things are as they should have been all along. It's pretty neat. There are two biblical words for that. Restoration is one and redemption is the other. And they are amazingly beautiful concepts. And one of the things I want to get at tonight is this idea that redemption and restoration, these two concepts that I really believe they're just tied, they're all throughout Scripture. It's kind of the process that God is at work in the world doing these two things. He's redeeming his people and this world, and he's restoring it to the way that it should be. It's not just a future thing. It's not just something that happens when God comes back and takes his people home with him and everything's the way it should be. It's also happening right now through us. This redemption and this restoration is something that Jesus wants the church to be doing all the time. And so we are to be agents of restoration and agents of redemption in the world. And so with that comes some really crazy teachings out of Jesus' mouth. Okay, and all this is kind of intro to where we're headed tonight. Jesus' teachings, because they've been around, they make their way into our culture so much that when you read them, they get really watered down. But in the day, people responded to them the way that you would if I walked and said some of the crazy things that Jesus did. Like, for example, in John 6, he's talking to a group of people, a group of Jews no less, and he says, because this would have been especially offensive to a Jew, he said, "Hey, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part with me." Can you just pause for a second and think about how crazy that really sounds? Where he throws out this little, "Hey, by the way, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part with me." And there were a lot of people who were listening to him that said, "That's too weird. That is too weird." And they walked away. They got up and walked away. And even the disciples, I love this, the disciples come up to him afterwards and their exact phrase is, "This is a hard teaching." And if I can paraphrase Jesus, he was like, "Yeah, okay," but that isn't what he said. But that's my paraphrase of what he said. He said, "Yeah, it is a hard teaching." And the Sermon on the Mount, if you want just a best of list of those kind of teachings, read Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Awesome reading, okay? And in that, he has some things like, if your right eye causes you to sin, cut it out, gouge it out, okay? That's a hard teaching. Okay. I don't think that Jesus was literally telling you to do that, but he was underscoring a point of how important it is for our soul to be maintained. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. That's a hard teaching. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. You ever thought about that? I walk up to you, pop. "Thank you, sir. May I have another?" You know? Guys, would you do that? Now, I mean, I understand that gets complex quick, but let's not water down Jesus' words, shall we? If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other one. Now, this isn't where I'm going tonight. I just want to say, with a verse like that, Jesus isn't saying if someone's attacking you, you're not allowed to defend yourself. But he is saying in that verse, you don't have the right to just hit somebody back because you're humiliated. Could you actually do that? Out of strength and not weakness? Not just because you're afraid, but in having the ability but deciding to restrain yourself. Can you do that? That's a commandment of Jesus. Turn the other cheek. Martin Luther King thought you could. And in the 60s, that entire movement, he wasn't a politician, he was a preacher. And this whole movement, when he kind of became the voice for it, he began to preach this thing of nonviolent direct action. That phrase, over and over and over again, nonviolent direct action. You listen to his speeches, you hear it over and over and over again. You know what nonviolent direct action is? Turning the other cheek. It means being strong, not backing down, but not giving in to violence yourself. If they hit you, you stand there and you turn the other cheek and you take it again and you say, "I will not move." And you can take the other cheek too. He said this about nonviolent direct action. He said, "Nonviolence is a powerful and just weapon. It is a weapon unique in history, which cuts without wounding and ennobles the one who wields it. It is a sword that heals, both a practical and a moral answer to the oppressed people's cry for justice. Nonviolent direct action proved that it could win victories without losing wars." Amazing. Jesus is teaching. Later on in Matthew 5, I'll put this one up, and this is where we are camping tonight. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Can you do that? Love your enemy. So we're talking about, if I asked you to imagine that person who has wounded you deeply, I mean, that one that you have imaginary conversations with when you're alone, the one where you're like, man, if I just had that conversation back, I would have said this and this and this and this. That person that if you see in Walmart, you'd probably, like, avoid, walk the long way around the store so you don't see him. Jesus isn't just saying to forgive them. He's saying, love them. And in a different spot, I don't know if I wrote it down here or not. I think it's also in Matthew. I believe it's in Matthew 18. Jesus and Peter are talking, and Peter says, hey, how many times am I supposed to forgive somebody who sins against me? Seven times? He's being generous. Seven times? A lot of times. And Jesus says, how about 70 times seven? And Jesus isn't asking him to do the math. I mean, it's not a literal number. The idea is perfection, 70 times seven, infinitely. Jesus is like, instead of seven, how about infinite forgiveness? How about there isn't an end to the forgiveness that you offer someone who sins against you? But here he's taking it even a step further. Not only are you supposed to offer forgiveness, but you're supposed to love them. How's that work? Do you ever think you could feel love? I mean, for someone who's wronged you that badly? Well, let's look. Let's look at that tonight. There are, in the Greek language, I'm going to try to hit this quickly because there's other stuff I'd rather focus on tonight. In the Greek language, there were four main words that they used for love, okay? And we actually take a lot in English. I was a lit major. I love to get geeky with language, so just stay with me for a second. If you're not that person, I'll move through it fast, okay? They had all these different words to describe love. And philia, for example, is a Greek word that for love. And we get the name Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. We get that from the Greek word philia. And it is. It's a brotherly sort of love. That Christmas time feeling of peace on earth, goodwill toward all man. You know what I'm talking about? Just a general goodwill. I hope everybody has a good day today. Is sort of a philia type of love. It is a well-wishing kind of love. Mankind is my brother, and I wish him well. Philia, okay? Eros, E-R-O-S, eros, was a Greek word. We get our word erotic from eros, and so you already know what it means. Sex, lust, passion, the sensual side of love is summed up in eros. Storge is a less used, but was a Greek word for love as well. And it had to do with family, you know, like blood is thicker than water. Your family love, the familial love that you have. It's like, I can make fun of my brother, but you don't make fun of my brother, okay? Because blood's thicker than water, and he's my blood, so you can't do that. That's the storge kind of love. And agape is, you might have heard taught on before, agape was a kind of love that the New Testament talks about a lot. New Testament's written in Greek, and so oftentimes when you see the word love used, for the most part, you're looking at agape. Now, here's why that's important. The word agape is used when God talks about the type of love that he has for us. And agape is used when the Bible talks about how we are supposed to love God. And agape is used when it says this is how a husband is supposed to love his wife. And a wife is supposed to love her husband. It's the word agape. It's not philia. It's not eros. It's not storge. And when when Jesus says, I want you to love your enemies, he's saying, I want you to agape them. Well, if it's used in all those connotations, we should probably know a little bit about what it means, because it would make sense for us, wouldn't it, to be like, we should philia our enemies, which means, I want you to get to the point where you wish them well. You know what? I forgive you. I don't care. I hope you live well. Philia would make sense. Eros, I don't think we know that Jesus is probably not asking us to, you know, sensual thoughts about our enemies. And storge doesn't make sense. He wouldn't use that one either because you're not talking about family relationships. But agape is a different kind of word. And agape is a kind of love where it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with how you feel. It has more to do with what you do. Agape is putting someone else's interests ahead of your own interests. Agape is doing the right thing regardless of whether or not you felt like doing it that morning when you woke up. You with me? And so it's important here when he uses the word agape that he's not saying, I want you to fall in love with your enemy. I want you to feel really good about that person. I want you to serve them until you guys are like best friends again, is not the command that Jesus is giving. And if he did, I don't know how we'd do it because it would seem awfully impossible to me. What he's saying is, I want you to treat this person, this situation, selflessly. I want you to take yourself out of the equation. Okay, well, let me get to the latter, okay? When we have a problem with somebody, let's say that Phil and I are roommates. And Phil's constantly leaving his dishes in the sink, and it drives me crazy. Phil's not my roommate, by the way, so I can feel free to say this. And I get frustrated with Phil because his dishes are constantly in the sink. And so my process, I have this ladder in my head in all the relationships that I have, and Phil's down there. And the fact that I'm having to do his dishes again bothers me, okay? And I'm going to stay on this rung for a while. I'm not going to talk with him about it. I'm not going to deal with it. I'm just going to stay here, okay? A few weeks goes by. We're all supposed to pay. I mean, we're living there with a bunch of guys. We're all supposed to pay our rent on time. Phil's is late. My name is on the lease. The landlord comes and talks to me. I say, hey, I can't get it yet. He yells at me. I have to go back and have a conversation with Phil about it. And so I get a little bit more frustrated. Any people not like heights in here who are not liking this right now? Big ladder. I love it. And in the ladder that's inside of us, there is no end. I know this one's big, but you can go a long, long way on that ladder, okay? We have some more miscommunication about stuff in our apartment, and Phil's like, he went home for a couple weeks without telling any of us. We were going to do some other stuff around the house. Nobody knows where he's at. We haven't talked to him. And so now I'm like up here with Phil, okay? And by the time Phil and I actually talk, it's going to be a yelling match. And my pride is high. I'm developing all these arguments. Whenever I'm sitting and thinking about Phil, I'm thinking, you know what? If he did his dishes just once, it would help. How many times have I done his dishes? How many times? And I don't have to ask any of the other guys for help with the rent. I don't have to do any of this stuff. And I just keep going up and up. Every relationship you have, this is your natural human response. All the time, up the ladder, again and again and again. Jesus, if you'll notice, was in the habit of going down the ladder. He often chose to forgive people who didn't deserve forgiveness, didn't ask for forgiveness. All right, audience participation. Think of a biblical time where Jesus forgave somebody who didn't necessarily deserve forgiveness. Prostitute. Tax collector. Any others? Any other specific situations you can think of in Scripture? The adulterous woman who's dragged out in front of him. What was the other one? Yeah, the criminal on the cross who cries out for mercy and Jesus offers it to him on the spot, who was a criminal. I mean, he was being crucified for a reason. Was there another one? Judas. I mean, we'll talk about this one a little bit later also, but get this image of Jesus washing Judas's feet, knowing that he's going to betray him. Does that not scream treating somebody else above yourself? Any others? You say Peter? Yeah, Peter denying Jesus, and then you have this scene with Jesus where Jesus is kind of like lovingly bringing him back after he has just left him hung out to dry. Any others? Paul. Yeah, Paul. Paul gets forgiven for murdering Christians. I mean, it's Jesus, that thing that I was talking about before, about him restoring and redeeming, he wants to be restoring and redeeming our relationships. And this is the advice that he's giving to help us do it. And I got to tell you, there's going to be a lot of fallout between Phil and I if every conversation that I have with him is up here. And Jesus is saying, you don't have any business up here. You don't have any business at all up there. It's not your ladder. But that's the natural progression. It's always up. And Jesus is trying to give us a safety valve to help us understand that. What did I do with my notes? My wife and I occasionally argue. And I want you to understand, I've come to a place in relationships, all of them, friendships, my relationship with my wife. I believe that conflict is a good thing, okay? I'm not looking for it. I don't mean I wake up in the morning and I'm like, we're going to fight about something today. Like, this is, though sometimes you do wake up feeling that way, but that's not a good thing. I'm not recommending that. But conflict, when you have two people who both have backbones and two people who love God and two people about who have an idea about how life is to be lived, there should be a little bit of disagreement in there, some friction over how do we do this thing together. That's friendship too. And it's a good thing to be able to figure that out. God gave us ways to figure that out together, but this messes it up big time. And so when I'm in a fight with my wife, I'll call it that, okay? When we are disagreeing over something, like I said, it's okay for us to passionately disagree over something. We just have to understand that we're on the same side and we have to stay off that ladder. If I start working my way up the ladder, she's got her own ladder over there, and we both are working our way up the ladder, and we're both getting frustrated with each other, and we both realize the other person's not seeing our side. Hey, guys, I want you to listen carefully to me here. You've heard the phrase spiritual leader in relationships before? You know, whenever I ask the question, hey, who's supposed to be the spiritual leader in a relationship? The answer is always like, the guy. The guy is supposed to be the spiritual leader. And that's, we treat it like it's this big honor. I have some news for you. You ready? You may not like this sermon. Spiritual leadership in the church is imitating Jesus, who gave himself up, who laid himself down. And in that moment where I'm getting frustrated, God does this. It's frustrating. In that moment where I'm starting to climb the ladder, here's what I hear God say to me, spiritual leader. Not right now. On my ladder. Because if I'm the first one to get down, if I surrender that stuff and I recognize that the relationship is more important than me being right, it makes me look weak and it makes her look right, and I don't want either one of those things to happen in that moment, okay? But that's what Jesus did. That's spiritual leadership right there. He says, lay yourself down for her good. Husbands, I want you to love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. You want to be a spiritual leader? I genuinely don't think that means that you are the one who organizes Bible studies for your house. You can, that's great. I don't think it matters to God whether or not it's you or the wife who's doing it. But I do think, guys, he's going to hold you accountable for being the one who comes off the ladder first, for being the one who serves first, for being the one who calms a conversation down, for being the one who treats other people with honor and dignity. I think that's the kind of leadership that Jesus had in mind for us, gentlemen. But it requires coming off the ladder. The cool thing about human nature is, oftentimes when you do that, the other person will follow. When you come down and you say, you know what, I'm sorry, I apologize that I was getting frustrated, and usually what happens is the other person reciprocates that. It's a beautiful process that God's called us to in that. Loving your enemy means that even though you have the right to be on step 90 of that ladder, you're going to surrender that. And you're going to look to their interests ahead of your own. All right, let me give you a different situation. We moved here about 8 years ago, and the house that we moved into is sort of out in the country. We'd had a house before. We never owned a house before. We'd rented a house before. But, you know, we lived in Charleston, and there was always, I mean, like, no offense, but I lived in dorms in college housing for a really long time. And I didn't want to do that anymore with a family. I was really done with college housing, you know, just like thumping stereos at 3 a.m. and that kind of stuff. I just was like, okay, get us a house in the country. That would be fantastic. And so we did. We bought a house that's kind of outside of town. I mean, it wasn't to get away from campus. It was what we could afford that had a yard for our kids to run in. And so we go out there, and we have a neighbor that my kids, for a long time, we had to get them to stop saying it because my kids just kept calling him the bad neighbor. Be like, where were you at? I was over in the yard by the bad neighbor's house. It was like, don't call him that. You know, I was afraid he'd say that really loud. I'm over by the bad neighbor's house. Be like, though he probably wouldn't have cared, because the guy, I met him early on, and actually the time that I met him, it was fitting, because he was drunk out of his mind, and we had sort of like half of a conversation, but that gave me a preview of what the rest of our relationship was going to be like, because at 10 p.m., 3 a.m., 5 a.m., 8 a.m., it didn't matter, any time, the music from his house. He had a system that had to be better than what we have here. And I'm not joking, because we'd like in the middle of winter with both our houses closed up, there'd be times in the far corner of our basement that just crystal clear, I could hear his music and lyrics, and I'd be like, I don't even know how this is possible for, you know, how the sound is getting into our house this far, rattle stuff on our walls. And so the first year or two that I was there, year or two, keep in mind, and we have little kids who are waking up when this stuff's happening, which is really frustrating after you work really hard to get them asleep. I'd go over to his house because I was like, you know what? I want to take care of this face-to-face. And I'd go over there, and every time he would either be stoned out of his mind or drunk out of his mind. And he'd turn the music down, but we'd barely care. It was so bad that we could just barely carry on a conversation. And then the next day it would happen again, or a couple hours later it would start up again. So I did this for a really long time. And finally, I was like, you know what, I just need to go over and tell him, if this happens again, I'm calling the police. I don't really want a neighbor relationship like this, but you're not giving me any choice. And so I tried that, but every time I went over, he was so far gone that I knew he wouldn't remember having the conversation with me. So I wrote him a letter. Actually, I wrote him two or three different letters. I tore up the first couple versions because they were not something God wanted me to send to him. And so, yeah, I'll let that thought stay over there. And so I sent him this letter, and it was to the point. It didn't mince words. Basically, in a nutshell, it said, anytime I hear your music, anytime, and we had other problems with our dogs being in our yard and all kinds of other stuff, and I was like, anytime this stuff happens, I'm going to call animal control, or I'm going to call the police. If the police find you as stoned as I've been finding you, you're not going to like the process that's involved in there, okay? Now, this did not help the situation, all right? And I'm already fighting my ladder in this. I'm pretty far up the ladder, and God's continually having conversations with me trying to move me down the ladder, and it's not going well at some points. Because, you know, I have a tendency toward being a little bit vindictive and creative, and those are not good qualities to combine in a situation like that, because I had all these beautiful ideas of stuff that I could do to him in his house, and like, and God kind of kept drawing me back in on that. And I was like, so I did okay on the outside, but most of these battles were not won on the inside. I'm just going to tell you right now. And it got worse bad. After he got that letter, he started like blaring music when my kids would be out in the yard. He'd like find the most vulgar music that he could, and he'd crank his stereo so the kids couldn't be in the yard. And because we live outside of town, it takes the cops a half hour to show up. So of course, by that time, he's not playing any music anymore. And this guy's got more felonies on his record than you can possibly count. So even like the worst threat that a cop could give him, if a cop had to go back there 20 times, would be a court appearance and a misdemeanor. And trust me, he had so many felonies that were currently being worked through at that point that they were tossing misdemeanors off of his record because they just wanted to get at the rest of the stuff. So what I'm trying to tell you is it was a hopeless situation for us. Like legally, there was not a whole lot that we could do. We could call the police, well actually, there was something we could do because this is what we did. We called the police continually. To make a really long story short, I'll catch you up later if you're really interested, but to make a really long story short, they suspected that he was growing weed. One of the cops there thought he saw that he was growing weed in his basement, and so they took a SWAT team there with M16s and dogs, and they kicked in his front door and threw in a concussion grenade, it was a pretty amazing thing, and they hauled him off. They hauled him off, and he spent about 2 years in prison over all of that stuff. And throughout that time, you know, there's a part of me that's just dancing, okay, on the inside as this is happening. And it's like M16s and concussion grenades. And they sent, you know, the dog that has just been in our yard, and I'm like worried with our kids, and I've had conversations with them about it. And this dog, they sent a canine unit in first to this house. So like all these German shepherds rushed the house first. And that dog was so scared that it disappeared for like a week and a half. It was scared to come home because of all the other dogs that are there. And so, I mean, it's a mess. The whole thing is just this beautiful mess. And but God won't leave it alone, you know? Because if you'd asked me at that time, hey, Ben, who's your enemy? I would have responded, my neighbor. He started mowing his lawn at like 11 p.m. at night just to try to get on our nerves. You know, it's that kind of stuff that's going on, and I'm trying really hard not to go back and forth with him in that, because God's saying, "Hey, love him." And in my head, I'm thinking, God, I can't imagine you bringing this guy back. I can't imagine you changing his life so that he loves you again. And I felt like I didn't hear these words, but I feel like the process that God brought me through in that was, hey, Ben, you have no idea what I might do in that guy's life, and I might need you to do it down the road, so keep your mouth shut and keep your nose clean right now. And you can be stern, but love him like he's your family member. So it's not that I couldn't call the police. It's just that I couldn't, like, retribution wasn't in God's plan for him. And so as he's in jail, you know, there were times where God was like, you know, kind of pulling on our hearts a bit to be like, we'd be getting stuff out of our garden, and we'd be like, you know what, we should take some of this next door to his wife, Sharon. And so we'd walk over, and it's crazy awkward because she's been a part of all this too, and to be like, hey, we have extra stuff in our garden. And times where we'd go and rake leaves in their side yard and mow and do other stuff because stuff seemed to be getting out of control in their house. And he got out of prison, and the music's been better. He still doesn't like us. Will God ever redeem that relationship? I don't know. But he wants me to be a piece. If it's going to happen, he's brought us into that process to be a part of it, not to break it farther. You with me there? He wants restoration. He wants reconciliation. He wants redemption. And he wants to use us to be a part of it. And again, I'm going to tell you, it sounds like a success story on my part. I fought a lot of inner battles there. Every time I heard his lawnmower, I had to get to the point where it was a reminder for me to sit down on the spot and pray, because otherwise I'd be too angry. And so I just had to be like, okay, God, in those moments where I hear his mower at 11 o'clock at night, I'm just going to sit and pray for him. And I hope someday that when he brings it up, I can say, hey, because I knew from our previous conversations also that he was very anti-God. I was hoping I could just say, hey, every time that you were mowing, trying to frustrate us, we started praying for you, praying for peace on your family, praying that you'd know to come to the Lord. Pray for him. You know, those conversations haven't happened yet, but maybe they will. You know, he went on a real downward spiral again a few months ago, and then it seems like things are different again. So I don't know where that's going, but I know what God wants in it, ultimately. So a couple of things here. Jesus, we talked about Jesus earlier. John 13 is that passage where he washes his disciples' feet. Can you picture that in your head too? Him gently. I mean, this is one of the last things on earth that he has the chance to do, because he's going to be crucified and he knows it. He's got the disciples together and he washes their feet, takes on the nature of a servant. There's a theological term for that out of Philippians 2 when it says that Christ emptied himself. The Greek is kenosis, is what they call it. It's a theological term, just a fancy word for saying that Jesus emptied himself by coming to earth. The whole thing of coming down off the ladder is a picture of what Jesus did, period, for us. Kenosis, that Jesus emptied himself and came down to be one of us. And beyond that, in his final visual aid to his disciples, he says, this is how I want you to serve each other. He goes beneath us, dresses down to a servant, goes to each of his disciples' feet, starts washing each one of them. One by one by one by one. Gets to Judas, washes Judas's feet. Crazy picture. Crazy teaching. This is a hard teaching. That he would gently wash the feet of Judas. If God is willing to do that, then what are you unwilling to forgive? If God's willing to forgive you, if he's willing to take on that other person's sin that you're so concerned about, shouldn't you be able, and shouldn't I be able, to forgive like God has forgiven us? I think a prerequisite for understanding and knowing this kind of forgiveness is coming to terms with the fact that God forgave us in that way. Okay, so there's two different things that you might land in tonight as application. And I don't want to take it too lightly, because some of it shouldn't be taken too lightly. But category one forgiveness is petty. They're things that are small. They're things that we dwell on. It's the road rage over somebody cutting you off on the highway. Let it go. We have got to learn as the people of God to come down off this ladder over things that are small and petty, and that we shouldn't be small and we shouldn't be petty. When we see that in comparison to what Jesus Christ has forgiven in our lives, it should embarrass us. Knowing how Jesus has forgiven us should help us let things roll off our back that don't need to bother us. So if I ask you, how is it in your life that you need to show forgiveness, and what comes to your brain is petty, my advice to you tonight is to let it go, to move on, to ask God to help you show forgiveness, and to leave that in your past. But there are other things that aren't petty. We had a really good friend who, as an adult, she'd pushed this down for years, but she'd been through a sexually abusive relationship with her dad, and she was talking to my wife and I about that, and that's not something you let roll off and walk away from. And there were some hard conversations that had to be had, some wounds that had to be torn back open to confront some things that had happened a long time ago. But do you know what? God still wants redemption and restoration in something even as ugly as that. He does. And it was a slow, painful process, but it's getting there. It's not been easy. And I may ask the question, who is it that you need to forgive? And the answer that comes to your brain is something that may be a category two. And that is, I need to figure out what forgiveness looks like for this person. Now keep in mind, forgiveness doesn't mean that consequences go away, you know? If you come to me, if you come to me and say, hey, I probably should go to this person and ask for forgiveness because I committed a felony, I'm probably going to end that counseling session by saying, hey, let's talk and let's call the police, okay? Because there are consequences to actions. And forgiveness doesn't mean that those consequences go away. You know, I mean, if somebody came up and beat one of my children, trust me, there would be consequences. You know, the police would be involved in that. I can forgive them for it. I hope that I would be able to get to the point where I would be able to forgive somebody for doing something like that. It'd be really hard. I hope that I could get to that point. But regardless, there'd be consequences that follow. And so there may be situations where you need to seek out wisdom and good counsel from people around you that know the Lord. And you can say, hey, what do I do with this? I need to be able to give forgiveness. It doesn't necessarily mean that the person is released from the consequences of their actions. What I know is that in community, God intended for us to be people who do not live up there. There's too much pride up there. Miscommunication, it can't get solved up there. Your ability to forgive other people, it doesn't happen up there because you're standing on top of all of the reasons that you have, all the baggage that you have in your relationship that you can fight for. A marriage cannot exist well up there, not healthy. It can't. And the problem is, it's great if one person gets off the ladder, but it's still messy. You got to have two people who are willing to come down and meet at the bottom and say, all right, I'm going to look at your interests right now ahead of my own. I'm going to make this selfless. Kelsey, if you could put Colossians 3 up there, read this with me. Out loud, if you would. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. Man, if you hear nothing else tonight, hear that, because that's the model. Jesus came down, and so should you. It is really hard to hold unforgiveness against somebody in your heart and to have Jesus standing right next to you forgiving that. Go read the parable of the unmerciful servant if you don't know what I'm talking about. If Jesus has forgiven us, we owe it to him to forgive others. And if we can get that, we are one step closer to the garden. Restores relationships. It brings a little bit of heaven here now, redemption and restoration. Someday, I don't know what it's going to look like. I can't even, you know, I can't imagine it with my mind's eye. Someday we will be back in a state where it is not work to have a good friendship with somebody. Because there won't be manipulation. There won't be miscommunication. The body of Christ, it won't be work. But right now, friends, it is. It's hard work. It's hard work to maintain relationships right. It's hard work when somebody wrongs you to go to them right in the moment and to say, hey, maybe I shouldn't even be upset about this, but this is what happened. And you talk it out one-on-one before you got 15 other people up on the ladder with you too. You know that process as well? Because you never want to be up the ladder alone. You want to take 15 people up there with you so they all know your side of the story. And when that person comes in the room to have the conversation, it's you and 15 other people at the top of the ladder being like, we are not happy with your decisions. You know? It's not the way problems get solved. There is a freedom and a beauty that we tap into in the Spirit of God when we allow him to bring forgiveness into our lives in that way. So a couple more songs we have tonight, and these really are focused around Jesus because he's the example in that. Him dying on the cross is the perfect example of the forgiveness that we're talking about. And I'm not talking about just a generic forgiveness. I'm talking about him coming down the ladder, him lowering himself, him putting himself in a position where he is beneath us and putting our interests above even his own.